This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Most big decisions in the world, companies, governments, school boards, you name it, they're made in groups. Sometimes big groups of people who try to weigh the risks and opportunities and make the best decision possible.
But do groups usually emerge with the best decisions? And what are the usual landmines of decision-making by committee? How do we get to the best outcomes when we have to talk and decide things in a group? Well, our next guest is here to weigh in. Cass Sunstein is a Harvard Law professor. He served as administrator of the White House Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs in the Obama administration, and his new book is called Wiser, Getting Beyond Groupthink to Make Groups Smarter. Cass, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's start with a basic question. In general, does the process of deliberating in a group usually produce the best possible decision?
I think if we want a simple answer, the answer is no. It depends a lot on how the process is structured and what the group is like. But all too often, groups silence their individual members. There are conformity pressures on people who actually know things, so they don't say what they know. Leaders speak first and loudly. People are inclined to blunder within groups. That's just kind of consistent with how human beings sometimes are. And when they're inclined to blunder within groups, often the group amplifies the blunder rather than correcting it.
So does that mean we're better off lone wolfing it, coming up with a decision with one decision maker?
No. So I wouldn't go that far. What I'd say is that the best way to do it, really, is to have a group process that's alert to the problems that groups are subject to. So in good firms that are successful, good local government offices, good White Houses, good nonprofits, they are alert to the problems of group decision making, and instead of using a lone wolf, who also can go wrong for sure, they try to aggregate the information that their members actually have.
One of the things you say that can go wrong is people sort of pile on. One person speaks early in the game, they're optimistic, and people sort of fall in line. What's going on with that dynamic?
It's actually the word is a cascade, and it's a little like a waterfall. So what can sometimes happen is there's a group, let's say it's a group of 12 people, they're figuring out what to do on some problem. Someone speaks, and that person says, we should go forward with the approach that's on the table. The next person might think, well, I'm going to have to be very clear that that person is wrong to disagree with him or her, so I'll agree. And then you have two people who think that the course is a really good one. And then the third person would have to be very confident or maybe truculent to disagree with the first two. And I think we've all seen this, where the early movers in a group end up determining the outcome. Even though they themselves may not be so confident, they end up sometimes inadvertently even silencing the rest of the team.
So how do you set up a committee or a group to make sure that people with doubts express their doubts, even if two or three other people have expressed the opposite view?
There are three things that a team or a leader can do that are pretty simple. One is a leader can think, if I want to make a good decision as a part of a group or the leader of a group, I'm going to be very quiet myself and make sure that people don't think that I have a clear inclination. The smart leaders in some of the best groups in the United States are modest and humble, at least at the beginning of the meeting, about the particular topic of the meeting. That's the first step. The second step is that you can try to inculcate a culture where what it means to be a team player is not to agree with everyone else and not to participate in happy talk. Happy talk is often a big obstacle to good decisions in workplaces and even in families. You want to be friendly and cordial. But if the team leaders inculcate a culture where the idea is a good team player is someone who contributes to the group's pool of information, not someone who smiles and agrees with everybody, that can be super helpful. That's the second step. The third step that is really used in a lot of companies, sometimes formally, sometimes less formally, is to assign roles to people. So you might say, okay, I want you to be the expert in this and focus on this. I want you, someone else, to be the focus on that and to focus on that. I want you to be my worst-case scenario person. Think about how things go wrong. And I want you to be the person who's concerned with, say, public relations, how the public might react to this. And if you assign roles to different people, then you tend to overcome the problem of conformity pressures and groupthink.
Now, you mentioned happy talk, and you write some in your book about happy talk and the people who embody that, and then sort of the anxious manager approach. Which one is better?
Anxious is better. So you don't want to be wringing your hands and in despair. But I'll tell you a little bit my own experience in the White House. Whether you like the president or not, there are people in any White House who are constantly thinking, how can a policy go sour? If we have an economic plan in the midst of a recession, what are the problems associated with the approach we're tending to favor? If we're rolling out some parts of the Affordable Care Act, how can they misfire? Those are the anxious people. Then the happy people or the complacent people, maybe the better term, is they're thinking everything's going to be great. That that this is the best thing since sliced bread, maybe even better than sliced bread, and we don't have to worry much. And in any White House, the anxious people, so long as they're basically upbeat about the prospects, but at the same time that they're aware of counterarguments, they're aware of what might go wrong, they can be a great service to the country. And if you look at the successful companies in the United States, Google, Facebook, Intel, they've actually had very good mechanisms for making sure that possible downsides arise to the manager's attention so that a company doesn't get defeated by complacency within the organization.
But isn't there a risk of the anxious people having too much control, too much negative input, and you don't have the positive think big vision that lets you do something new and innovative?
Yes. So a mix is good, and the word anxious shouldn't be taken too literally. You don't want a leader of a company to be sad and worried and making everyone in the company think we're doomed. But you can be, and there are people in high places in both the Republican and Democratic Party, and certainly in corporate America, and definitely in the nonprofit sector and labor unions and religious organizations. We all know them. They're upbeat people. You wouldn't describe them as having as their first characteristic anxiety, but you can trust them in the sense that their optimism is accompanied by parts of their mind that are constantly thinking, how can things go wrong? If you're a public servant, you're thinking, this is a program we mean to help the people of Wisconsin, but maybe it's not going to work out right. If it doesn't, why not? And how can we anticipate that? Or if you're launching a new product, maybe new sneakers, new line of shoes, and you think it's really great, if you have people in the company who are upbeat about the potential but also thinking about the downside, that's what's meant by an anxious leader. And there's the head of the National Economic Council in the White House right now, a guy named Jeffrey Zients. Republicans love him. Democrats love him. He's a very likable person. He's a terrific manager in part because there's a part of his mind that's always thinking, if this goes sour, how exactly would it go sour? And he was actually the person the president called in to fix the healthcare.gov website when it wasn't working so great. And that was the right choice because he's got that kind of anxiety, the kind we're now discussing, he's a problem solver.
You hear a lot these days about the wisdom of the crowd, going to your social media connections, asking everyone who's out there and plugged in for an answer. Does that yield good decisions?
Under certain conditions, it can. So here's the basic idea of the wisdom of the crowd. If you have a group of people and each one is more likely than not to be right, if you ask a bunch of people, a large number of people, then the average member or the majority view is really going to be right. And the old TV show, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, I think it was called, the statistics show that if you ask the group, the studio audience, that was actually a very good thing to do to find out was right. If you ask your lifeline, who was your chosen friend or expert, that wasn't quite as good as asking the audience. And that's just an example of the wisdom of crowds. But there are a couple problems with this. If you have a bunch of people who are influencing one another in the crowd, then their groupthink can get them to think something that's really false, like something about how terrible a certain country is when in fact it's not terrible, or how some rumor that has no basis is actually true. Large numbers of people can get that if they're influencing one another. And if you're a group of people and you're asking them something on which they have no information base, you're asking them something that's really technical, then there's no particular reason to think that asking the group is a good idea. You want to ask people whose business it is to figure out these things. If you're trying to figure out how to handle a complicated brain surgery, you should probably ask a group of brain surgeons and not use Twitter.
Cass, we leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Pleasure.
We've been speaking with Cass Sunstein, professor at Harvard Law School. He served as administrator of the White House Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs in the Obama administration. His new book is called Wiser: Getting Beyond Groupthink to Make Groups Smarter.